coming into this. Okay. Let me just see here whether. No. Okay. Yes. Yes. Generally speaking, all the rabbis served as judges. Generally speaking, and generally, even in the Hebrew, we don't really understand all the dimensions of what the word Rav means. Forget his name. He was called Rav. Okay, but he was called Rav because he, just as he was a student of Rabbi Judah the Prince, right? What was he called? Rabbi. So he was an Eretz Yisraeli. He was a Palestinian, an Israeli judge, rabbi. His student was the first of the Babylonian rabbis. So similarly, he was given the title Rav, par excellence, as his teacher was the rabbi par excellence. He is the rabbi par excellence, but he's given the Babylonian name, which is Rav. Okay? The duties of the rabbi, I don't think no one has really adequately studied this. Because the rabbi was a combination of many different things. The rabbi was certainly a teacher, no doubt about that. The rabbi was a decisor. If there were questions that came up, the rabbi made decisions. And a lot of those were not what we would call decisions of a judge, per se. If a chicken is kosher or not kosher, that's a decision that has to be made. Okay? And a lot of the law is ritual law. A lot of the law is ritual law. In these areas of monetary law, they're more subject to, it's not the only area of law that's subject to a court proceeding, as we know. We saw in the first Mishnah that we began with, there are a variety of different numbers of courts for a variety of different purposes in courts. So rabbis had that position as well. Rabbis also, and you can see this even in the rabbinate today, it was an issue, for example, when the seminary discussed women in the rabbinate. The Israeli rabbinate to this day thinks that that's just it's off the wall. Totally crazy. I'm talking in general, the Israeli rabbinate, which is pretty well organized and quite strong in the state of Israel. And I was always of the point of view, which was a unique point of view, I would not necessarily have advocated if there was something that was in the tradition that prohibited women from being rabbis. The problem was that I knew what rabbis did because I was a rabbi. I really know what I really have a lot of insight into this. Every once in a while, even people on the search committee ask me what rabbis do. Okay. A little bit of insight into the nature of what rabbis in fact do.
Kosher chicken.
And I know that the rabbis do all kinds of things, and much is determined by sociology. And the reality of what religious institutions are wherever you're living. And rabbis then take on certain roles. So I knew that, and I knew there was really no halachic issues. I couldn't see any reason why the women couldn't do exactly 95% of what I was doing. Had nothing to do with halachic things. It was just irrelevant. There might have been a small percentage that could be relevant, but it surely, there's no reason why somebody who felt similarly would just say, this is not for me to decide, as I don't decide on a lot of things. Frankly, I get certain questions that I ask other people to answer, because I know that some people know certain areas better than I do. So I'm just saying, the reality of the rabbinate is the rabbinate that does many different things. And one of the things that's amused me in the Israeli rabbinate, which you can see particularly in the Sephardi rabbinate, is that the rabbi is also a magician. You have that among the Hasidim, and you have that among the Sfardim. The rabbi is a magic worker. And rabbis do all kinds of wonders. They're wonder doers. And it's a little odd for those of us who are coming out of the American rabbinate. It's true in the Orthodox rabbinate as well as in the non-Orthodox rabbinate, because we're not used to that. Rabbis generally are not wonder workers in America. But if you go, if you see the way the Israeli rabbinate works, it's a certain whole piece of that rabbinate that in fact is people go for a rabbi to perform miracles. And the rabbi is a miracle worker. So it depends on where you are and what the sociology of the community is. And here, it is. There's no doubt about the fact that the rabbi is also a judge. Play that role.
There is just a story that was about a few months ago. Abu Hatzira that got killed by somebody in Sderot, or the little town around there, and he was killed by one of his followers, that the miracle didn't come true. Abu Hatzira is one of the leaders of that.
Abu Hatzira is one of the big names in the Sephardi world, correct.
And he got killed by his followers.
Did it come through?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This one?
Well, there is a whole Abu Hatzira family. There's a whole family, sir. There's a whole family of Abu Hatzira.
Not the top one.
The old one died a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
The most famous one is gone. He went the way of all flesh, as we say.
Okay,
we go on. Ki hava chaze ambuha de safre avatre. When Rav would see ambuha, I'm going to look here, just about on the right, if you just go over to the Talmud page, the Hebrew, I'm going to follow along in the next several comments on Rashi. Just go over to the right, into the Rashi, which is on the left side of the Talmud page, the Hebrew page, just down about 3-4 lines. Go over to the right. It's Ambuha. Si'at Anashim, a group of people. Okay? Ki hava have Ambuha de Safre. The word Safre just helps it. It's an explanatory term in parentheses. Safre there are teachers, scholars. Scholars, like Sofrim. When a group of scholars would, when he would see a group of scholars, avatre, following after him, Amar, still the subject of this is Rav. Rav would say, In yalele shamayim si'o kegalalo lanetzach yoved. He would say, this verse, which is from Job, In yalele shamayim si'o, if his stature rises to the heavens, in other words, I'm such a famous rabbi, right? Everybody's following me, he shall perish forever like his waste. In the Hebrew, if you look in the Rashi there, in yalel shamayim, kedei shelo chazuch tazuach da'ato alav hayal merkach. In order to make sure that he kept his modesty, he would say to himself the following, and he would say that, you know, if my reputation goes up so high, my end is that I am going to perish kiglalo. And Rashi defines that galal re'i. In other words, like a bowel movement. Ultimately, my bowel movements and I end up in the same place. So when he saw people following him, it's very gross, but it kind of makes the point. It kept him humble. To remember where we're all going. Mar Zutra Chasida ki havu mechnatfe le v'shabte derigla. Mar Zutra Chasida, when his students would carry him on their shoulders during the Shabbat of the festival discourse. Now, go on again in the Rashi. B'shabta deragle, Shabbat shesho'alim bo b'hilchot haregel. this was a Shabbat, that they would begin to study the laws of a coming festival, the Hainu Shloshim Yom Kodem HaRegel. That's to say, this would take place 30 days before the beginning of a festival. So there would be a major teaching session 30 days before the festival, at that Shabbat, which fell in the 30-day period, the first one that fell in the 30-day period, in order to teach about the festival. So he was a major person, and then they would carry him. They would carry him on their shoulders, so that he would, the students would be sitting here, and Rashi says that in order to just save time, he was an elderly person, and just to walk among all these students who are effectively sitting on the ground, they would carry him on their shoulders to get him up front so that the group of people who are assembled there wouldn't lose their patience. They wouldn't lose their patience, okay? When they would put him on their shoulders, of course, once he goes on the shoulders, he's a big shot. He's a big shot. Carrying the teacher on their shoulders. Amarachi, he would say this. Ki lo leolam chosem, riches are not forever, the im nezer ledor vador, nor does a crown endure for all generations. The crown, of course, is the crown of the Torah, because the scholar is the person who wears the crown of the Torah, Keter Torah. That person is crowned by the Torah itself. His dignity comes from the Torah, but of course, his end is the end of all human beings. Okay? The crown will not be passed on to his children. It's not like a normal king. Rather, it will simply go to the next person who has the crown of the Torah. Okay? Darash Bar Kapara. Bar Kapara taught the following. Mina ha milta di amru rabbanan. Mina, from where in the scriptures do we know what the rabbis have taught? Hevum mitunim badin. Now this is maybe familiar to you. That's the beginning of the Tractate of Avot. Alright? So the beginning of Masechet Avot. First teaching is Hevum mitunim badin. Be deliberate in judgment. Okay, where is that derived? Tichtiv. Lo ta'aleb ma'alot. It is derived from that which is written, do not ascend on steps. Usanichli ve'ela ha'mishpatim. And right next to it is written, and these are the judgments. Now this goes back to what we were just reading before, the end of Parshat Yitro, before the very beginning of Mishpatim. I read to you as far as the gods of silver and gold. I'll go on from there. Make for me an altar of earth and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your sacrifices of well-being, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be mentioned, I will come to you and bless you. And if you make for me an altar of stones, do not build it of hewn stones. That's very basic. That's the original source of this. Do not build it of hewn stones. For by wielding your tool upon them, you have profaned them. I'm not exactly a question about why, but that's what it says. Then it says, do not ascend my altar by steps. Do not ascend my altar by steps. Lo ta'ale b'ma'alot al mizbechi. Do not ascend my altar by my steps. And it gives a reason. So that your nakedness may not be exposed upon it. Okay? So the reason given here in the Torah is if when you walk up steps, it's a skirt issue. It's a skirt. You lift, the skirts get lifted as you walk up the steps. So for the sake of modesty then, if you walk up an incline, you can take smaller steps, and therefore the skirt will not be lifted. You can take steps of any length you like. When you're simply walking up an incline, you'll get up there. Okay? No, it's on an incline. It's on an incline. It's just the... Yes, correct. And the altar in the temple, here in the Mishkan, and then finally in the temple, is an incline. The Kohen would walk up the incline. Had to go up an incline. Okay? So that reason is actually given here. Then, keep in mind, the next verse is the first verse of Parashat Mishpatim. The Torah then goes on and says, Ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. These are the roles that you shall place before them. Okay, that's what it says here. Now, I'll go back here to our text. Remember, we are trying to find the Torah source for the rabbinic teaching, Hevu mitunim bedin, be deliberate in judgment. Be deliberate in judgment. Usanichli ve'ele ha-mishpatim. Or first it says, Lo ta'ale b'malot. You shall not walk, ascend on steps. Usemichle ve'ela ha-mishpatim. Next verse it says, these are the judgments. Now, let me see what Rashi says here. Bima'alot. It's about halfway down the page on the Rashi side. Because it's just a continuing from where we left off before. Bichazaka ubimerutza. Rashi understands this to mean to be strong and running. In other words, running up steps. Running up the steps. Lo ta'aleba malot. You shall not run up steps, but you shall be mitunim bedin. All right? Because the next thing it says is Ela ha-mishpatim, right? You shall be deliberate in judgment. It's in a way slower to walk up the incline. Slower to walk up the... I don't think that Rashi is right, but forgive me. Forgive me.
We won't tell.
I think that what this means is something slightly different. What it means is Lo ta'aleba ma'alot, you shall not go up in ma'alot, in steps. I think what it means is that you, the judge, should not be lofty. You should not think you're such a big shot. You should not think you're such a... Lo ta'aleba ma'alot, in other words, your ma'aleh, your status...
Don't be above the
other. Don't be someone who thinks he has a tremendously high... Lo ta'aleba ma'alot. Don't walk up in your status, but rather, because the next thing is ve'ela ha-mishpatim, these are the laws, okay? You, it's not status, but you have to judge in terms of the laws. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim. That's my interpretation of this text here.
Does the language mirror what's said for the Tower of Babel? Because the Tower of Babel was a series of steps.
Well, let's take a look and see. It's in the Parsha of Noach. Let's see what it says.
They've proven it's a series of steps with ramps, but it went around instead of steps.
Well, let's see. A lot of this may be the result of the pictures we know of it, and I'm not sure what it says in the Torah.
I'm just curious if the words were the same.
So let's look and see.
Because it's clearly the imagery of putting yourself above.
Vayihi kol ha'aretz shafa achat udvarim achadit. Everyone on the earth had the same language and the same words. Vayihi benos am mikedem. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them hard. Bricks serve them as stone, and bitumen serve them as mortar. And they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in the sky to make a name for ourselves, else we shall be scattered all over the world. The Lord came down to look at the city and tower that man had built. The Lord said, if as one people with one language for all, this is how they have begun to act, then nothing that doesn't say anything about how they went up to it. Doesn't say anything. It's not unreasonable to think that the imagery is still appropriate imagery, because the problem there was that they were going up to the divine place, as it were. So here, it's a similar idea, that's my argument, that they're raising themselves up to where they really shouldn't be, because their job is to adjudicate the law. Ela ha-mishpatim.
It's funny, when I first read it, my sense was saying be more deliberate in judgment as opposed to taking giant leaps from one place to the next.
But that's Rashi. That's why Rashi is interpreting it. That's the way Rashi is interpreting it. Because instead of running, but my experience is, I'm not sure that you could run a lot faster up steps than up an incline. That's what. Well, maybe that's true. I don't know. Rashi is apparently is understand. That's true. You're going faster. That's correct. So that's a point to Rashi. That's a point to Rashi.
Judges all are on elevated places today.
That's true. That's true. Judges are always on elevated places. Correct. You're right. I'm just trying to think. Interesting, because in the Masechet Sanhedrin, one of the things that's dealt with is how judges sit. I don't think that judges are told to sit above. They have to sit in a semicircle so that they can look at each other. But I don't think that, because indeed, in fact, you're quite right. In our modern courts, the judge always has to sit high.
He's on a
beamer. Right? The judge always has to sit in the beamer. That's correct.
But why?
Why, Mort?
To differentiate us.
I'm not sure why, but I had a different thought about this. We talk about the judge should be deliberate in judgment, and in terms of the night of sin, I'm stepping, if you also think about it as that the judge should not send and get so abstract in his analysis.
Oh, that's
that
good. Very nice. Right, that's another possibility. Good, that's very good. Right. He's got to be down to earth in his judgments. Just trying to think. And all this can be metunim badin. All the things that we've said can fit in this. Havu metunim badin.
When you take steps, usually it's a shortcut between one place to another. When you have a ramp that goes zigzag, you do things in a slow motion and you have enough time to think it through.
It's all a rush. Good. Yes.
Isn't there a chapter in Bereishit that starts with Ela and it's a problem or it's an issue as to why it starts with that word?
In Bereishit?
Somewhere before Mishpatim. Because I thought I remember Ela talking about a chapter.
A chapter? Let's just think for a second.
Why does it start with this word? And isn't it odd that it starts with this word Ela? Maybe I'm wrong. Because I think it explains a lot if it's a necessarily a linking word, that it should say, don't do this because Ela Mishpatim.
Well, I think what you're probably thinking of is that it doesn't say Ela Mishpatim, it says the Ela Mishpatim.
Okay.
The Ela. And there the Rashi's comment is, why the Ela? Okay? It may be that, because that's a really, that's something that's constantly referred to. So that may be it.
Can I add a little visual to this? Because Laura kind of got me started thinking about the imagery of the Tower of Babel, which I think goes back to Google the Elder and then many, many copies of that. But I'm thinking that this point might be nicely illustrated with Escher. Everybody knows Escher? With stairs that go up and convoluted, they're up and they're down and you're not quite sure. So I'm getting that kind of convoluted steps.
Okay.
I think we could illustrate it with that.
However, you could use the metaphor that you used of the crown, that is, the rock in interpreting the law is he's not the law.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be the elevation on the bima, if you will, even in contemporary courts. Is not of the man, but that no man rises above the law.
Yeah, of the law itself. My guess is that's probably why the modern judges raised. It's probably the reason. And that's a good reason. It is a good reason. Yes, they're representing something lofty. Right.
But I'm going to make an argument for step by step.
Okay.
Step by step is acknowledging precedent.
Oh, yes.
Well, but I think that deserves to be said, because I think that is an important
concept. No doubt about it. At least in the context here, the context began with, what is the Torah source of Hevumet in the Medin? And I'm suggesting this. Of course, once they're onto this, they're going to not leave it so quickly, because they like the Torah.
And their deliberateness in the incline might be to feel the weightiness.
Where do we know, again from Torah, that a judge should not step over the heads of Am Kodesh, meaning the Jews, the holy people? Here, again, the picture is the one that I used a moment ago, that is to say, where the people who are present, who are either studying or who are there in order to hear the court proceeding take place, they are sitting on the ground. And the widespread presence of chairs is a very modern institution. It'd be interesting to see even in relatively modern times, but you know, not in the 20th century, but say in the 18th century, whether in public places people had chairs. I would bet they didn't. When you see, when people watch, for example, I'm thinking of French, and I often go back to French pictures, movies, where you see a beheading, all right, in a public place. Everybody stands for it, right? Many things go on in public places. They were not necessarily indoors. Frequently things were outdoors. You didn't have necessarily large public places for things that were public.
Not to disagree too strongly, but in class this past week, I saw an image of an auto da fe, and it was a giant auditorium-like setting. The people to be burned were on one side, just a few of them, but people were seated in some fashion.
Was that a picture, a contemporary picture?
I believe it was, but I'm
the contemporary
not
of the. Because one of the things that I've sometimes wondered about.
The Globe. Everyone stood except for the Queen.
Everyone stood in the Globe Theater?
Yes.
That's very interesting. So that would be.
There was a seating for the Queen. That's but in ancient Rome.
Caesarea, they had benches, that's true.
And they were, so they could recline while they were sure.
Because the description in the Gemara is always of the students seated on the ground. That also could be. It may be that we're talking that's in fact people sit on the ground in the Middle East. This is an Eastern kind of thing. Interesting. Shinemar lo ta'ale b'malot, because it says, do not ascend on steps. In other words, lo ta'ale b'malot, don't go higher. Don't go above people. Usmichle, and the next verse is, the Ela HaMishpatim, these are the laws. Okay, so in other words, in the context of the courtroom, which is this place where people are sitting on the ground, Lota Leva Malot, you shouldn't be above people when you walk in. Okay. and of course we're referring to the judge there. Ashotasim. Now here, once the Gemara has gotten us into the beginning of Ela HaMishpatim, these are the judgments, it's going to go a little bit further with this. Remember the verse is, Ve'ela HaMishpatim, these are the laws, Asher Tasim Lifnehem, which you shall place before them. The Gemara then says, Asher Tasim, these are the judgments that you shall place. Asher telamdem mibayale. It should have said which you shall teach them. Why does it say that you shall put them? Amar Rabbi Yirmiya de'ite, Amar Rabbi Chiya Baraba, Rabbi Yirmiya, and some say that Rabbi Chiya Baraba said, Ele Kleya Dayanim. This word refers, Ele Asher Tasim, you shall put. This refers to the tools of the judges. The tools of the judges. So what are those? Rav Huna ki hava nafik ledina amarachi. When Rav Huna would go out to a judgment, he would say the following. Apiku li mane chanutai. Take out from me the tools of my trade. Tools of my trade. Makel, a stick. All right. A stick in order to deliver a punishment. Ritzu'ah, a strap. Okay. Vishofara, a shofar. And sandla, and a sandal. The last two, of course, are obvious. A shofar is in order to declare somebody in cherem. This is a case where somebody is put into cherem. There's a shofar blown. Sandal, you know where that's used?
Chalitza.
This is a woman who has no children, the husband dies, the brother of the husband is required to marry her, doesn't want to do it, and there is the ceremony of chalitza, removing of the shoe. Right? So the judge has to have one of those. And of course, the makel and the ritzu'ah are forms of punishment. Now, I don't want to say anything in this, because let's look at the next one here. All right, the Gemara goes on and talks about the makel and the ritzu'ah, the forms of punishment. Doesn't want to leave this once it gets to it. All right. Va'atzave et shoftechem ve'etahi. And I commanded your judges at that time. This is referring to Deuteronomy 1, beginning with verse 16. And this is going to be a very long, lengthy discussion of this area in Deuteronomy. And I'm going to read it to you in a little bit, but I just want to get through this first. So let's just look at what it says on the surface. Va'atzave et shoftechem ve'etahi. And I commanded your judges at that time. Atzaveh, I commanded your judges at that time. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, Keneged makel uritzu'ah, tehei zariz. You should be, well, zariz, whatever that means. Keneged makel uritzu'ah. First of all, it says, Atzaveh. In fact, strangely enough, the Torah itself doesn't use the form Atzaveh all that often. Or Tzav et Bnei Yisrael, command the children of Israel. And whenever it does, when it uses the form Tzav, or Atat Tzaveh et Bnei Yisrael, we have two parshas that begin that way. One begins Tzav, the other one begins Atat Tzaveh. In both cases, the rabbis ask why this sudden emphasis on the importance of doing something. And in both those cases, it's because what immediately follows is expensive. And the analysis, therefore, is that people don't, when you tell people to do something, if it doesn't cost them much, there's more likelihood they'll do it. If it costs them, they don't want to do it. Okay? So in both those cases, that's it. And the way it says it in the literature is you have to mizarez them. You have to
prod them.
That's a good word. Thank you for that. That's a good word. You have to prod them. You have to prod them. Okay? So here it says, Va'atzaveh et shoftechem. I will prod your shoftim ba'etahi in at that time. Well, how do you prod a judge? In fact, you're not prodding the judge at all. You're giving the judge a prod. That is to say, you're giving him the means, you're saying to the judge, this is really important. This is really important. Okay? Dehei zariz. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, keneged makel uretzu'ah. This is done in order to give the judges the makel, the stick, and the whip, in order to be able to get the job done. Dehei zariz. You should prod the people. Okay? You'll have to use that from time to time. Okay. Now, I want to show you the Rashi on this, and we're going to read the Tosafot also. It's one of these cases where it pays to read both the commentaries. First, let's look at the Rashi. Because I'm sure that when you read a stick and a whip, the modern reader reads this and is uncomfortable with it. Okay? We're not particularly comfortable with this. For better or for worse. I mean, it could be you spare the rod and you spoil the child. Okay? But this is where we're coming from anyway. Okay? Klei HaDayanim. Let's start back a little bit here. Klei HaDayanim. Can you see that in the Rashi? Klei HaDayanim, the Shaycha Baho Sima, the tools of the judges, which is relevant to be talking about putting them someplace. It's physical. These are tools which you put someplace. Davar HaMitpalpel, something which is movable, which is carryable. Right? Ritzu'ah, the strap, Lemalkut. Right? This is for those punishments where the Torah itself tells you lashes. There are lashes that are the punishment for certain infractions of the law. Makel, the stick, le makat mardut, ad shiach zorbo. Makat mardut is an infraction of the rabbinic law and not the Torah law. Makat Mardut is a technical term which refers to somebody who will not abide by the will of the rabbis once they make a judgment. Sandal lachalitza. Shofar. Leshamata v'nidui. That's for leshamata nidui is putting a ban on someone. I said cherem. That's effectively the same thing. Sandal lachalitza. And those for chalitza. Va'atzaveh, kol tzeva'a l'shon zeruz. Wherever that terminology of tzav is used, that indicates a zeruz, a prod. Hu detanya, as it is taught, kol makom sh'ne'amar tzav, as it's taught in the Baraita, every place where it says tzav, eino el l'shon zeruz, is for the purpose of prodding. Va'al ma zeres, for what purpose do you have to prod? Al hamakel va'al haretzu'ah. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about the stick and the strap. Sheyehiyu metilin eima ala tzibur l'shem shamayim. Because they will result in casting the fear of heaven upon the public. Right? It's a very classic idea which you have until very, very recently, that the purpose of punishment is to create fear of transgressing the law. And corporal punishment is a very effective way of achieving that. Okay, it's a corporal punishment. Everyone, stop here. Yeah, so you see the purpose of the punishment is in order to achieve that level of fear in the public. Now I want you to go to the Tosafot. Tosafot on the right side of the page, the right side of the Talmud page. In this particular page, there are two Tosafot. There are just two Tosafot. Can you see where that is, Bobby? Do you find it? The first one is in large block letters. It says, She'eino tzarich lichlum. And the second one says, Tehei zariz. Okay? Right. You have to be prodding. You have to prod the people. This is the counsel to the judge. Tehei zariz. Now, look at what the Tosafot say. Shelo lahatil ema al hatzibur. You have to prod not the people but the judges so that they will not terrorize the community. Lirdotam yoter midai, in order to scare them too much, to rule over them with too heavy a hand. Exactly the opposite of Rashi. Exactly the opposite. What the Tosafot say is that the counsel here of Zeruz is counsel to the judges, to prod the judges to make sure the judges don't misuse the power that they have. Rashi says the opposite. Rashi says the whole idea is to get the judges to use their power and to terrorize the people. Right. So the Tosafot say it's to make sure they don't terrorize the people.
Isn't it very often that the Tosafot do this kind of disagreeing with Rashi?
I wouldn't say very often, but it's some this level of exactly the opposite is a little stronger than what we usually used to. Very often they'll say something like "V'lo nireh." It doesn't make sense. And they'll explain, therefore, the thing somewhat differently. That this is such an absolute opposite. One says lahatil, the other says lo lahatil. Okay? Quite extraordinary. Now, remember when these people live. This is the generation of Rashi's grandchildren. Somewhere. Rabbeinu Tam, for example, was his grandchild. Rashbam was his grandchild. So some of them actually were his grandchild. But beyond that, it's a generation. It's two generations later. Okay? So you can see sort of the mellowing of the generations, as it were. The younger people are against. Maybe. They have the experience of their grandfathers. I don't know about you. How many of you have experience of your grandfathers taking off their belts and using it for corporal punishment?
My father used your father.
Your father did. Your father did.
My father did.
Your father did. Okay. My father did and my grandfather did. I remember that was the ultimate threat, and it was every once in a while acted on. It's not that it was just a vain threat. We knew what that belt felt like. Okay? So it doesn't go back so far.
Really want in terms of society are both these things. We want the judges prodded.
I suppose so. I suppose so. Depends on how you prod, though.
But it depends on how you prod in either case. But
exactly.
I would think that the society is best served, okay, with both those.
Yes, I don't. I think that you're absolutely right, and it's a question of how to do it.
If I understand this correctly, it seems as if the judge does mete out some of the punishment that he rules upon. But when did that happen? Was that from the beginning? And at what point did somebody else do
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that.
I'm surprised that the judge himself.
Sometimes the judges did it. Sometimes the judges did it. Not always, but sometimes they did it. Sometimes the accuser did it. The accuser did it. Remember where the Torah itself says that if a person is brought on a capital crime, family brings, here's interesting, the family that brings, as for, in our society, for example, the state brings a case. If something's a criminal case, I was just dealing with this recently, the state brings the case and the family doesn't bring the case. That is, if it's a civil, if there's a civil, what if this came up just recently? What was the context? Where was this? This was last week. Where was this? Was this in New York State that the court decided, well, this is in New Jersey. That was a case in New Jersey about the boy, the student who put in the camera, who had the camera, correct. Right, at Rutgers, right. So I asked someone who was more knowledgeable about this what the force was of such a decision. And it's explained to me what I hadn't understood, which was that to some extent what was revolutionary, in the, if you can call it that, in that decision was the notion that this was not a civil matter nor a tort, but this was a criminal, this was being dealt with as a criminal matter. Many issues of discrimination, let's say, are not dealt with. You can bring a case against somebody, but the state doesn't bring a case. If you've been wronged by something, you can bring a case. When something is a matter of the criminal law, as the judge was saying that this was a valid issue in criminal law, then the state brings the case, and it's not an individual's case. It's not a civil case.
It's interesting, though, that it's a criminal case. It's okay, even though the state brings the case, tries the case, prosecutes the case. The family is invited to watch the execution. You see, it is.
There you go. That's where I was coming from. I got into that because of that. The Torah says, "He who has brought the accusation shall throw the first stone." Okay, in a capital case. So that's the same idea here. Okay, so we have a modern transformation of it, but it's a similar idea.
And it's true in the Islamic law, in rural, Islamic places like
that. Yes, and they still do exactly that.
The families, okay.
Yeah. Actually do it, yes. Correct.
No, the family kills the guy that killed the family member.
Exactly.
So they can agree to a payment and have the death penalty heard.
You know, there was a case.
They can? The Islamic law? Or?
Oh,
yes? Trust me. Bobby, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, is it possible that, a lot of what we say about penalties are that they're deterrents, that we need to have this because the fact that it's on, one case or the fact that it's on the books will be a deterrent for future crimes. And it could also be that the judge didn't use that so much, but put it there, the tools, as deterrents, so that they saw that there's a possibility of clash, there's a possibility.
You put your stuff in front of the community so that everybody sees it.
Kind of thing necessarily.
It's a good idea. Right. That's very good. So it's the public nature of the thing. That's tasim lifneihem means actually put it very publicly in front of people so that it functions as a deterrent. Very good. Very nice.
Or at least to get people to testify.
How many fathers, just touch their belt without ever taking it off?
That's correct. And the job is done. Correct.
The look.
The look is... Right. It terrorizes. It brings terror, such a look. Very good. Okay. Now, here, again, you see the way the Gemara has been structured. It will bring a verse to prove something because of the nature of an argument. And then once it's brought the verse, it sticks with the verse. It did that with the Ela HaMishpatim. It gave us another teaching based on that. Now it has brought the verse, Va'atzaveh et shoftechem ba'etahi. I commanded your judges at that time, and it's going to stick with that verse. It's actually a few verses. and bring a number of teachings as a result of that. I want to take a look at that. That's in the first chapter of Deuteronomy. It's worthwhile remembering how the book of Deuteronomy begins. This is the end of Moses' life, 40th year of the wandering in the desert. They're about to go into the land, and the function of the entire book is to review much of the law, and to some extent to review the history as well. So in chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, Moses gets right down to the basics. It was in the 40th year, or this is just the setting of it. The Lord our God, this is verse 6, spoke to us at Horeb. Horeb is Mount Sinai. That's another one of the names for Sinai. And saying, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. Start out and make your way to the hill country of the Amorites, to all their neighbors in the Arava, the hill country, the Shephelah, the Negev, the sea coast, the land of the Canaanites, and the Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. That is to say, get out from this mountain and go to the land of Israel. Right? That's where you're supposed to be. See, I placed the land at your disposal. Go, take possession of the land that the Lord swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to assign to them and to their heirs after them. Thereupon I said to you, I cannot bear the burden of you by myself. The Lord your God has multiplied you until you are today as numerous as the stars in the sky. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase your numbers a thousandfold and bless you as he promised you. How can I bear unaided the trouble of you and the burden and the bickering? Pick from each of your tribes men who are wise, discerning, and experienced, and I will appoint them as your heads. Okay? You answered me and said, what you propose to do is good. Verse 15. And I took your tribal leaders, wise and experienced men, and appointed them heads over you, chiefs of thousands, chiefs of hundreds, chiefs of fifties, chiefs of tens, and officials for your tribes. Verse 16. Va'atzave et shotrechem lishivtechem. Va'atzave et shoftechem. And I commanded your judges. Atzave et shoftechem. That's what we're talking about. Ba'etahi lemor, at that time saying, Shamoa ben achechem. Shamoa is a rather strong form here. It's written, interestingly, Shin men ayin. It's pointed with a dot after the ayin, after the mem. Shamoa, hear, listen, bein achechem, between your fellows, ushefatatem tzedek, and you shall make a judgment of tzedek, a righteous judgment, bein ishu bein achivu bein gero, between one person and his kinsman, his fellow, uven gero, literally, and between his stranger, and between his stranger. Lo takiru fanim mamishpat. You shall not be partial in judgment. Kakatan kagadol. Hear out low and high alike. Tishma'un, you shall hear. Lo taguru mipeish. You shall not be afraid of any person. Ki hamishpat l'Elohim hu, because judgment is God's. V'hadavar asher yikshe mikem, and the matter which is too difficult for me, for yikshe mikem, that will be too difficult for you, takrivun elai, bring near to me, ushemadativ, and I will listen to it. And I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do. Okay? That is a good piece of the first part of chapter 1 of Deuteronomy. And just to point out a few things for you to think about. This is now, Moses is recalling history and recalling the formation of a system of courts. And remember when this was done, God says to him, leave Horeb and go to the land. So was this done before the revelation at Sinai or after the revelation at Sinai? After. When we read about it in the book of Exodus, do you know when it happens? At the beginning of Yitro, Jethro comes and says, Moses, this is never going to work. Right? You have to set up a system which is a workable system. That is why the rabbis say that the whole story of Jethro is out of place. The whole story of Jethro seems out of place. And the question is, did Jethro come before Sinai or after Sinai? And in the rabbinic tradition, there are two completely different ways of thinking about this. Okay? One, that he came before Sinai, and the other is that the Torah doesn't give you the natural order of things as they happened, but the Torah sometimes changes the order. And there's always then a reason for changing the order. And one of the reasons now that this whole issue is raised is because of the book of Deuteronomy. Because Deuteronomy, in fact, has it in a different order. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, we say that it says here, Lotis, well, what does it say? Va'atzaveh shoftechem ba'etahi, and I commanded your judges at that time, Shamoa ben achechem, ushefatatem tzedek. Okay, keep that in mind. Okay, this is a little aside, however. Rav Kahana Amar, Mehacha, Milo Tisa Lo Tasi. Rav Kahana learns the same thing from an earlier place. This is actually in Exodus 23, just this little piece is from Exodus 23, which teaches the same thing. But let's go on. Ushefatetem Tzedek. Okay? You shall make a righteous judgment. Amar Resh Lakish. Sadek etadin akach acharkach chotchehu. First determine the tzedek of the din. Make sure that you're convinced that the judgment is a righteous judgment. The acharkach chotchehu, then render it. Then render it. That's the force now. Ushefatatem tzedek. Right? Shefatatem tzedek. Lishpot is to actually render the judgment. But you have to do it. You have to be convinced of the righteousness of it before you render a judgment. Okay. Bein ish uvein achiv, between a man and his brother. Amar Rav Yehuda. Afilu bein bayit la'aliyah. Make an exact, well, here it doesn't, let's take it literally. Even between a house and the aliyah and the
boydim.
The boydim. The boydim is used in modern Hebrew too, is the loft. The loft, right. They use in Hebrew, they say boydim.
Boydim is Yiddish.
Right, boydim is Yiddish. Even between the house and the loft. Okay. So here, let's see if we have a Rashi here. Yeah, go to the Rashi here. This is now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines from the bottom of the Rashi. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Bein ish uvein achiv. Between a man and, literally, his brother. Between a man and his brother. Shenafla lehem bayit biyirusha. Right? A man and his brother received a house as an inheritance. Al Tomar, do not say, this is the counsel to the judge, don't say, Altamar tol ata bayit. You take the house. The achicha aliyah, and your brother gets the boydom. Right? Uma bechach. Why should it matter to you? Hare lechol achad yesh lo dira. Each person has a place to live. You can live in the house, and you can live in the boydom. Okay? Both have a place to live. You might think this way if you were a judge and you were dividing up this inheritance. Ella, rather, ha'ale otan bedamim, rather you have to create an evaluation of how much these places are worth, v'hashvei chalukatam al yedei ma'ot, and you have to equalize out the division of property so that both get equal value from the property. Okay? That's why it says, Afilu ben bayit la'aliyah, this is ben ishu ben achiv. When you're dividing something in an inheritance, that's a constant problem. It's a constant problem. I'm sure any of you who have been through this, when you divide out your parents' estate, particularly when you're dealing with small things, you know, I've actually counseled people on this. How do you divide up household goods? How do you divide it up? And there are a few ways to do it, because brothers and sisters can fight over this. It can be divisive. So one way is to try and render an evaluation of things. Another way is to randomize it. Just you all sit around a table. You make a list of the things. And you, heads or tails, you decide who goes first. That person chooses first. Next one chooses the next. And you go around, and you just go around like that, everybody having a choice.
It's not that way in a divorce.
A divorce is not called a Yerusha. All right, the Yerusha is an inheritance. The divorce is very different, very, very different, much more complicated. And that's why it says here, "Bein ach ve'achiv," okay, between the brother, between ish ve'achiv, between a man and his brother. And that's what we're talking about in this context. Okay, the next one.
There's no concept of a sister inheriting.
Well, you're going to see that the sisters are coming up soon. They're coming up. Correct. You're going to see they're going to come up. Uvein gero. Now the problem when we were reading it just a minute ago was, as you said, you translated correctly. Gero. What is? Why then bring in the stranger? What's the point here of the stranger? Amar Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says, Afilu ben tanur lekirayim. The word ger, which we translated as stranger, comes from a word that is like lagor, or migurim. Migurim is a dwelling place. So here, what Rabbi Yehuda says is that ger means the things in the dwelling place. The things in the dwelling place. In other words, when you are Shvatatem Tzedek, you are making a righteous judgment. You have to do an evaluation of the things that people are getting, even to the extent of things that might just seem that they're part, they're appurtenances of the place. Such as, for example, tanur lekirayim. A tanur is a fancier stove than a kirayim. A kirayim is a simpler stove. Okay? So you might just think you get one stove and you get the other stove. But when you're dealing with the Yerusha between two members of a family, could very well be that it's not just one stove and the other stove. Each stove has a separate value. So if in fact you are apportioning the stoves, one has got to get one and the other's got to get the other, it could be that one is worth more than the other, and therefore you owe the second party who gets the thing of lesser value has got to get something that equalizes the value. That is what we call mishpat tzedek. Mishpat tzedek. The key thing here is that everything be done righteously and that the judge be aware of all of these things, even as subtle as they are, as he is making the judgments, because in fact people's relationships will suffer as a result of this. And therefore one has to be very, very careful to equalize everything.
The court of equity.
The judge has got to be aware of that.
The court of
equity. Okay. Any other comments?
There, there.
Yeah. See, that's the interesting thing is the meaning of the word tzedek here. And that's why the examples that they are giving are really crucial to that. Because we don't know how to translate tzedek. Righteous, in English, we just don't have a context for it. But in this case, I think fairness is a good translation. Because you're seeing that's what they are really focusing on here. That in a case of inheritance, where judges will make judgments, that fairness is a crucial issue in making decisions.
That's true. If you buy that definition, okay, you know, of tzedek, I always associated tzedek with something like God given, okay? And in that case, okay, when you say righteous, you mean means according to what God said, okay? Well, that's one way to look at it, okay, rather than what's fair. What's fair to Gail might be different than what's fair to me, okay? But the point of fact, fairness is just something that's relevant. But righteousness, okay, I would think if you're related to God, is more absolute.
Maybe. But here it says, the Shvabat Dev Tzedek, when we are talking about an inheritance and money, in fact, judges make decisions about money all the time. And fairness is an application of God's will for tzedek. In this case. Okay? This is not the only use of tzedek, but it is a use of tzedek. Okay? To be continued.
He said that he would improvise.